sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A record high for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Greek drama postponed. Earnings season scorecard, and our special guest, co-author of Getting Big Things Done, Erica Dawan, joins us. All this and much more on episode number 401 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're at the third week of February. Options expiration just went off last Friday. And there are a lot of things that are going on. We saw some things in Greece. Russia over the weekend was downgraded to junk, according to Moody's. They're the second company that has now downgraded the rating of the sovereign debt of Russia. Now, this is important. And the reason why it's important is that Russia's having a big-time problem with keeping their money. Their banks are running out. As we have seen that oil prices are dropping, it's hurting many of the companies there. Remember something, that Russia, not only Russia, but Russia in particular, has one of the highest levels of requirements for general GDP related to the natural resource industry. And as such, when we see particularly petroleum and oil product going down pricing, and the fact that there is tremendous builds in inventory, we're seeing that that's really hurting them. Now, their banks are in trouble because they have limited amounts of assets these days being shut out of the international markets because of the various sanctions being put upon them from the United States and from Europe and other countries around the world. So they're in a heap of trouble here. What are they going to do? Well, they don't have much choice. Right now, what they have to do is make sure the ceasefire is maintained. That's a big issue. The second thing they need to do is they need to make sure that if that does occur, that they manage their assets properly, possibly even put on some capital controls where they're going to limit the amount of money that is being allowed to be taken out of banks. And they're going to have to figure out a way to recapitalize their banks somehow. So if they can keep the ceasefire going, and if in fact they can do what they can to make sure that no further sanctions are put upon them, they're going to be in good, well, better shape, I should say. But long term, it's going to take a long time for this country to dig out of the massive hole they have for themselves. Now, the good news that we're finding around the world, at least from the aspect of where things landed on Friday, was that the Greek situation is getting, I wouldn't say resolved, but postponed. The last minute on Friday before the banking holiday on Monday for Greece, there was a resolution passed that while they wanted a six-month postponement from looking at what they were going to do and possibly some of the potential problems they had because they were going to be running out of money, they needed six more months to start putting their ducks in a row, figuring out this anti-austerity program, maybe coming out of all the program requirements that were put upon them due to the massive bailouts that the Eurozone gave them. Well, now what we're going to have is 4 months. 4 months postponement, and that's good and bad. Now, here's really why it's all good and bad. It's good because it gives markets a little bit of a reprieve from the pressure where they felt as they were going up into this event. You know, there's a lot of concern. It didn't seem like a big concern, but concern on markets in the European side that, you know what, if Greece doesn't get any kind of additional bailout help, their banks pretty much are going to go under in a number of weeks, potentially, because of all the flows that were moving outside of Greece. The banks were just getting hit worse than Russia. I mean, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars were being pulled out of their banks, and capital controls were possibly the next thing that was going to be placed on many of these banking institution clients. Now, what happened is that they were looking to make sure that, well, while we're in this transitionary period, this is from the Greek side, now that we're in this transitionary period, we really need a lot more money to keep ourselves afloat till we can figure out what we want to do. Now, Russia's sitting there going, oh, look at these guys. At least they got something that they can bank on. Somebody's coming in to save them. The Eurozone is at least not putting sanctions on them, so they're pretty pissed off, I would think. Now, the Eurozone is saying, wait a minute. If you leave the Euro, you're going to just leave us a big mess. We have all sorts of hundreds of billions of dollars of bonds that won't be repaid, and who knows what this is going to spread to. So for right now, while it seems ridiculous for us to give you any more money, money that you tell us you're not going to repay us anyway, maybe what we'll do is we'll figure out a way to come in between all this. And maybe if you give us some concessions, Greece, we'll give you some money. Well, Greece pretty much had to bend over backwards. And even though all of these political agendas were put at play, whereas there was going to be a desire to make sure that wages were raised, that taxes were not going to be raised, that there's going to be infrastructure development, that there'll be no more massive amounts of austerity programs being done, Greece just could not handle the pressure. They have no money. There's a lot of good talk, but at the end, they never laid to stand on. So what they did now was, even though it's going to cost this new presidential regime a lot of political clout, what they did was very simply say, you know what, we can't do this right now. And you know, it's going to take time to really turn this whole entire situation differently. We can't be expected to overnight come up with a plan, and especially due to the lack of the funding that we have. So you know what, we're going to postpone this and we'll accept this. Now, the problem is one of the political campaign tools that were used in order to get Tsipras into government was that he was going to say, you know, screw you, Europe. We're not going to answer to the Troika. We're no longer going to answer to the Eurozone. We're no longer going to be watched over. And this austerity is for the birds. We're not doing it. What did they agree to as of the close of business on Friday? Well, the same situation. They're going to get money based on requirements and testing and constant oversight by the Troika. And they're going to have to answer a lot of questions. And the banking institutions are going to have to agree to all the different parameters before actually any money is released. So while on Friday there was a really big cry of hallelujah because of this postponement of just 4 months by markets, by bonds, by everyone, currencies, the fact is we still have to wait till Monday or Tuesday to see if this actually goes through pretty smoothly. So the whole thing, this is just going to go on forever. The fact is that there's no way Greece can get out from under the massive amount of debt that they have in any way except for pretty much just either defaulting on it or writing some of it down or getting a zero rate interest for 100 or 200 years. So I don't think there's anything that is so special about this. The only thing it's going to do is postpone what is clearly the inevitable, that Greece is going to have to exit the Eurozone or all the campaign pledges that were put upon the new president that he said he was going to do are just going to have to be absolutely abandoned. There's no way they can do what they want to do. There's no money to do it. They're not coming in from a position of strength. And in any business negotiation, if you're not coming in from a position of strength, you're going to lose. And in this circumstance, Greece lost big time. Now, again, just to give you just a little bit of flavor, the Greek market ETF, GREK, was up, I think it was 12%, 13% by the end of the day. The National Bank of Greece was up 20% on this news. And this all started riding up at about 11 o'clock in the morning, U.S. time, on Friday. This probably is going to be short-lived. I don't think that there's going to be a lot of people who have pulled money out of these banking institutions and have decided not to invest, except for some short-term traders, that are going to want to commit their money long-term to these banks with just a postponement without any kind of concrete plan that Greece is going to go along with. And if they fail any of the required tests or the required inspections that are going to go on, it could be a real big problem moving forward. But they got what they wanted temporarily, which is just some money from the Eurozone to make sure their banking system stays steady. And the Eurozone got what they wanted, which pretty much is not giving into anything that Greece wanted, except for the fact of giving them some more time. So this is something that we've seen time and time again with the European region, which is just simply postpone the inevitable. They have been doing this for some time. They are hoping to get themselves out of this big mess. They're in a deflation spiral. Mind you, some of the numbers that came out last week were a little better than anticipated, which is good because it can't just keep going down in a straight line. But the good news is that the euro is still very much cheaper than it was a year ago, that quantitative easing is coming into play very shortly, and that is good overall for risk assets, including equities. European markets will breathe a sigh of relief because of this postponement, at least for some time, and we're probably going to be right back in the same place that we were. While that's not a bad thing from the aspect of equity pricing, but you know what? Right now, there's been some strength that has carried over from the QE and all the economic activity that we've seen over the last year or so in the U.S. Therefore, people are still pretty confident in stocks, and stocks are doing well. What happens when and if markets start to change that dynamic, and all of a sudden this Greek thing then pops up? That's where your problem could be. So hopefully the timing on all this is not being done incorrectly. It would have been great to just get this thing blown out, take Greece out of the euro when people were pretty positive and stock prices were high. That would have been smart. It would take a little bit of a dent, but it isn't a long-term problem. If, in fact, they do this at the wrong time, when stock prices are vulnerable, when and if we see that the economic surprise index that we've been watching, whereas economic indicators have been coming in much lower than anticipated, really plays out, usually about a three-month lag, which then plays into this four-month postponement time period, that I have a concern with. Now, there's been a lot of companies that have reported earnings. We're going to talk about that after our guest. I want to talk about actually all the statistics that have gone on in terms of the culmination of earnings of the S&P 500 and how that has played out and what we've seen from not only earnings, but sales. I think that's going to be something we want to know about. And then I do want to answer one or two questions that I got from listeners. Of course, you can always send them to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's get to our guest right now. I want to talk to her because I didn't read the entire book, but I skimmed through a lot of it. Very fascinating information in there. And I do have some questions that I think that you're going to want to hear that I'm going to ask. And our guest today, we're going to change it up a little bit because we're not going to talk about finance in particular, but Erica Dewan, who is the co-author of Get Big Things Done, The Power of Connectional Intelligence. We're going to talk about what is connectional intelligence and how we can apply it. So how are you?
I'm great. It's wonderful to be here today, Andrew.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us. No, I wanted to pick a little point from your book that is coming out and talk about that to understand a little bit more about this whole idea of this connectional intelligence. So you wrote, "And now we are seeing the rise of something we call connectional intelligence. Our definition is connectional intelligence is the ability to combine the world's diversity of people, networks, disciplines, and resources, forging connections that create value, meaning, and breakthrough results." So this whole idea of connectional intelligence. So if we have all of this going on, all this connection through social media and all these different ways, how do we then have individual achievement? And I've been scratching my head trying to understand how everyone won't have the same awareness, therefore the potential for individual thought be muted. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Completely makes sense. And I think it's an important conversation to be having with the rise of connectional intelligence. So a lot of the ways we measure relationships, especially in the digital world, is about quantity of connections, right? Yeah. How many LinkedIn connections do you have? How many Facebook likes did you get? But in our book, Get Big Things Done, co-authored with my co-author, Sasha Nicole Jonai, we are really shifting that focus from quantity to quality. So building relationships that actually change people's lives, that create value or meaning, isn't just about having a lot of connections. It's about understanding how to make the smart connections, getting the right people together, collecting the important data, and using resources in the smartest way. And simply building a large network doesn't lead to measurable change. The key is how you use that network. And connectional intelligence is actually a human skill that those that harness it will be able to maximize the potential of their connections and put them to significant use. So I actually think this is directly in line with individual achievement in that we may be leveraging different people, resources, and ideas, But it's really, this is, I'm talking here about a human skill that certain people are better at than others. And I'm saying that those that harness their connectional intelligence will achieve more. And I'm not saying that everyone will automatically achieve more.
So with all of this, again, is this connectiveness. So I see some downsides. I got to be honest with you. I see some problems. One of the things is that, you know, in the old days, when you did math, there was a certain process that you went through. Today's math education is almost like just getting the result through all sorts of tricks and shortcuts and things of that nature. And, you know, using Excel as an example to do all sorts of very advanced calculations, but making it easy through functions. Now, there's a point to this. So if we don't understand the underlying way of actually, or the functionality and how things are put together, for example, I'm not saying you need to understand how your car is actually put together to drive it, but there's something to be said about, well, understanding how the car is put together to create the next generation of cars, to advance the technology, right? So when we have all of this going on in terms of utilizing this connected intelligence, is there a loss of the intellect of the underlying building blocks of learning and education?
It's a great question, Andrew, and it's one that I feel very strongly about. And I actually, I think that what connectional intelligence does is it accelerates our learning. It doesn't limit our learning. And the way that I'll describe that, and I'll frame it in my background. So I'm a Wharton undergraduate. I started my career on Wall Street. I worked at Lehman and Barclays Capital. And the curriculum at Wharton was very much in those days, that basic level of not, you know, I remember doing accounts receivable, you know, in my accounting exams, and really understanding the backbones of basic finance. You know, what the way that I would describe this is that we do have new tools that allow us to work faster. This doesn't deny that we have to know the underlying basics. And these new ways of working are not trying to circumvent the basics. I think they're trying to be added on to the basics of what already exists to accelerate learning, to allow people to work faster and learn better. And the example of this I'll share in our new book, Get Big Things Done, is through the example of Khan Academy. So Khan Academy is a free online learning website where basically it was started by a man named Salman Khan, who was a hedge fund analyst, and a couple of his cousins were having trouble with their algebra homework. They were in middle school. And so what he did, he lived in a different city. So what he did to help them out is he started to create these YouTube videos, which was just almost like a chalkboard. So it was just him speaking in the background, and he went through the homework problems, and he threw them up on YouTube, and they would watch them. But then what happened is more people started watching them, and soon enough, hundreds of thousands of people were watching them. And he started to realize that there was this huge opportunity to share these educational videos online. And there's a lot of different videos online, from basic financial services information to science to algebra. And today, millions of people use Khan Academy, but the way they use it is really interesting. What's actually happening now is teachers in schools are not don't feel threatened at all by these free online learning education programs on YouTube. They're actually using them to change and accelerate their classroom learning. So the specific thing they're doing is they are having their students watch these free online learning videos at night instead of just listening to teacher lectures. And then when the students come into the classroom, they're actually doing the homework. And what the teachers are doing is they're getting the data of who are the strugglers in the class, who are the strongest in the class, to allow those that are stars to keep going and those that are strugglers to get help. So what we're actually doing is we're shifting education to become more tailored, more customized, and more strategic. And today, Khan Academy actually has partnerships with in the financial world with Bank of America. They're doing a huge unleashing around financial education. So I actually think this is about unleashing breakthroughs in education through acceleration, more importantly, and adding on top of what already exists.
So what are you saying about the need for schools in, let's say, 10, 20, or 30 years from now. Because if you really take this to its next generation and its next possible conclusion, the fact is the more integration you have with many of these types of educational learning, well, today these are adjuncts, let's call it, of the educational process. But really, if you think about it for a second, what is the need if individuals can really adopt the use of technology for learning in a way that they are structured and it can be tracked and it can be, you know, the old no one left behind concept where those strugglers are getting maybe a different type of learning and you can find out how they're learning best as opposed to just sitting in a classroom and listening and everybody gets the same educational process. So if you get that one teacher that's maybe really good for half the class but not good for the other half of the class, well, it doesn't matter. Just the way it goes. But if you have some kind of technology that's out there that can teach in a way that will allow for the most effective way of learning to be encapsulated inside of an environment and then tailored for each individual student, what's going to happen to the traditional educational process where it went from, you know, the one room schoolhouse to where we are today to maybe in the next 20 or 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a much more blended learning model where we'll have a mix of traditional and online. And the reason why is that there's no denying that having a person next to you, helping you solve a problem, or being in a circle of other students really transforms learning. And there's no denying the power of human interaction. And in our new book, Get Big Things Done, we are not simply talking about technology. We're talking about how humans, anyone really, can use different forms of connection, whether it's interactive in small groups, in large crowds, online, you know, across the world, in radically new ways. And the key is how we combine all of those in a way that actually helps us get the big thing done we're trying to achieve. So if you are someone who's a coder, software coder, it might be fine for you to be behind your laptop, not have to go to college, you know, be coding with other friends on coder sites like Stack Overflow, which is a coder site where other coders learn from each other and share information. But if you're studying to be a scientist, I mean, it's really different. Yeah. So I think it really depends on what you're trying to do. I would say that that for business leaders and those in finance, obviously human interaction is so important. But I think there are many skill sets that we typically thought we had to go get an MBA for that we don't have to anymore because of the resources available to us for free.
And this tailors right into our last podcast. We had this conversation about the extraordinary cost of, maybe it was two podcasts ago, the whole idea that the current day student and the young person who's graduating from college with an MBA or even just, you know, any kind of diploma has a tremendous amount of student debt outstanding, which is choking them off. So this could be an interesting way to blend the idea of maybe getting a much better education, I suppose, without all the excess costs involved. Because,
yes.
Because a lot of things are free. I mean, I listened to Khan Academy in the early days. I remember when before Microsoft put in all that money into it and Bill Gates was all behind it and all that, I was like, hey, man, this is a cool thing right here. It was very, you know, you had to kind of find things. It wasn't everything in there like there is today. It wasn't as much videos out there, but I used it for my kids. I thought it was awesome. But let me ask you this. With all this connectedness, with all the, you know, ability to put all your, just kind of puke all your information on Facebook or, you know, whether it's any kind of social stream and Instagram/Snapchat or whatever it is out there that actually all these kids seem to be compelled to put everything they're doing between check-ins and, I just went to the bathroom, I just had a great bottle of wine, or just going out with this one, or just all their information. What are the implications with all of this connectiveness in terms of privacy?
Yeah, so great question. And Andrew, before I respond to your question, I actually have to reframe your question.
Uh-oh.
So first of all, it's not kids. Because first, if we think about the millennial generation, they're 50% of the world's workforce. And I would say that they're not puking all over these social media sites, but they're sharing because they want to share and document their lives. So I would reframe that. And I would say that the fastest growing segment on Facebook today are 55 and older. So the people that are actually sharing in today's world are not just 20-somethings. They're moms, they're veterans, they're senior leaders too that want to show pictures online. I mean, there are many celebrities that are incredibly active online sharing where they are and what they're doing. So the most important thing I want to, the biggest myth I want to bust before I answer this question is that it's not just kids, it's everyone.
Well, it depends on your perspective, what age you are, what you're calling kids, by the way. So yeah. just to speak about that, I get that. I'm not one that has been, I don't like to just share, you know, just not that I'm trying to hold back. Right. I just think there's a certain level of somewhat privacy, you know, of what there is. Now, a celebrity, on the other hand, you know, they're sharing so they could also promote, and there's a lot of other business reasons behind that. When I talk about kids, I'm also talking about the perspective when I see people that are younger that are, and I agree with you, obviously, it's everybody. You know, it could be any age. My mother posts all sorts of stuff on Facebook. Right. So you know, it's a little bit weird, but I get it. But my point is, what about this whole privacy issue in terms of, is there any implications that there is so much information out there on the individual these days that privacy could be a problem? And we'll get into the fact of hacking and, you know, utilizing the personal data in a negative way in a second. But I'm just talking about the whole idea of, is there any social implications that all of the privacy that we had before, because we were forced to without the internet, let's just face that, right?
Yep.
Is kind of been changed. Is it for the better?
Absolutely. Well, privacy has changed. I mean, I think that I'm not sure we are private anywhere. I think that with tools, you know, a lot of people have iPhones, cameras, iPads everywhere, from their bedroom to their office. And it's not, you know, just about people sharing where they were on Facebook, but the information sharing that we do every day just using our mobile phone, and that's anyone and everyone, is changing the course of what privacy really means. And I would say that I'm not sure exactly what privacy is today. And people that are, you know, the next generation that's rising up is becoming more comfortable with their lives being public because they're choosing to share them, or they know that they can't hide them. The challenge is, obviously, it can be used for great evil, and we've seen many stories of that. And I'm just going to say that I think that in the past, you know, public images have also been used for great evil. It's just going to be easier to do it. So I think it's something that we all have to be careful about. But it's not something that anyone can ignore. And I think that, you know, someone who thinks that, you know, just sharing on Facebook or Instagram is a privacy, you know, I agree that that by sharing more, you will become more public. But it's really for anyone and everyone with a mobile phone right now.
Okay, so let me kind of go into the next area. And that's the whole idea of, I have seen, and this is just my observation, it may not be truth by any standard, okay? But my observation is that there's a greater acceptance of information being factual when it is now available and in your face. Again, going back however many years, you know, what did you see? You had commercials on TV. We were always skeptical. You know, you say, oh, this is the best hamburger in town. Oh, yeah, really? Okay. They just say what they're going to say, right?
Right.
But today, where that stuff is out there constantly, and it's being promoted by businesses, also by individuals, there's a greater acceptance of the truth of what is written. Again, the old days, if it was in a newspaper, it was fact. Now it's like, okay, who knows what's true anymore? But I wonder, there's different social and sites related to, let's say, the stock market, which you have Twitter, which talks about stocks and finance a lot. There's chat rooms, which is another way of contextual intelligence, right? You have multiple people talking about different things. Does the fact that maybe the idea that all of this is out there and you have to research less, in other words, you could rely on other people that may or may not have, number one, done the research themselves, number two, may or may not have the best interests of other people's in mind. In other words, they're looking at benefiting from themselves. Does it make us do less work for ourselves and the research and all the things that used to go into proving to make sure something is factual?
I would say absolutely. I think that because certain things are easier to share online now, there is more buzz and there's also potentially more noise At the same time, there's more people that can call out buzz and noise. So 50 years ago, if there was a newspaper article, everyone would believe it. And, I'm not going to quote something specific, but there are cases when bullies ran newspapers and, you know, politics and business were very, and media were very intertwined. And so I'm not even sure 50 years ago what was always shared in the newspaper was the truth. And in today's world, one of the best examples of this that we talk about in our new book is the story of how Lance Armstrong actually got caught doping. And the real story is that he was a hero at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, the Live Strong campaign had just came out, and every media agency wanted to be best friends with him. So similar to 50 years ago, the media agencies wanted to be closest to the top celebrities. So actually what happened is a group of scientists that had access to Lance Armstrong's biking history looked at his data, and when they looked at one specific year of his racing, they saw no indication of doping. But when they looked over 10 years, they saw a very clear indication of doping. But the big media agencies were not interested in publishing this because, right, again, they wanted to be close to their friend Lance. And so the scientists published it on a small blog in New York called NewYorkVelocity.org. And after they published it, a group of young Facebook and Twitter activists who just cared about telling the truth about the about racing started to share this online, and that's what broke the story. So while the traditional media houses were more incentivized in certain ways to stay close to Lance Armstrong, a small biking blog combined with scientists is what broke the truth for all of us. Mm. So as we think about the rise of more content, of course, with that, we will have more noise, but we will also have more truth.
Right.
So it's a two-way patch. And I would say that, 50 years ago, we may not have had that. And we may never know many of, things that were actually lies that we were actually all told.
Mm. One of the things I think about with this whole idea of this connectiveness and this universal connectional intelligence and all of the things that are online. I kind of, for a second here, I was thinking, wow, this is kind of like the 60s where everybody was just, loving. And again, I'm giving a big picture here, flowers and happiness and sex and all that good stuff. And what happened from there was the incredible spread of, we called it back then VD, and now they call it STDs. But today I see the same kind of concept, but now that we have the barrier of technology, that's what kind of is the barrier right now, right? The potential for viruses, Trojans, and hacks. Do you see that similarity I'm talking about, that metaphorically, if you will? We were sharing a lot of stuff back then, and there was all sorts of disease spread. And today we have the potential of a lot of sharing and all that, but there's all the potential for viruses and hacking. We're seeing a lot of hacking noise. And a lot of hacking news come public these days. What's going to then, do you see this as a potential problem or a potential issue or some kind of a thing that people need to be much more aware of?
I think I wouldn't frame it as a problem. I'd frame it as an opportunity. So yes, when we're more connected, there are more hacks, last week, there was a measles breakout at LinkedIn, and the guy took the subway in San Francisco. And my sister, who's an infectious disease doctor, had to track everyone in the LinkedIn building because it's a collaborative working space and people are interacting. And, hacking online is a completely different topic. And so I'll say two things about that. One is, of course it's going to happen, right? But at the same time, we can track it better because of connectional intelligence. So this, again, is about a two-way street. And I'm one who is of the mindset of we can use connectional intelligence for good. And that's what our book, Get Big Things Done, is all about, because it can be used both ways. And I hope that, leaders, executives, those in the finance industry will use it for great good.
I hope so too. Again, I just see some of the businesses taking over and the building of all this, the trust factor in all this. Like we've seen this before, let's be honest. And then businesses come in and they just really try to herd us like sheep and try to direct us. And I mean, I could see that negative side. I can see the positive side as well, too, where it helps out, you know, if there is, for example, in some remote area of wherever, somebody who has an idea that may never have been found before can be, you know, maybe found now. Maybe it's a cure to a disease. Maybe it's a sequence for some kind of mathematical model that helps propulsion, whatever. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I definitely get that. I just hope that that wins out over the fact of businesses, which also can do good by this, but also can probably look to profit from it in a way that is a bit negative. I just see both sides of this very clearly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that businesses are incentivized to profit from many different things. So I think that this is a force for good to connect us in more powerful ways. And like any capacity, people can use forces for good or for not. But
yep. I hear you.
But I think the most powerful thing about this, as I shared in some of these answers, is that anything that is designed, you know, that could be designed in a negative way has a flip side in a very positive way. We can catch bullies faster. We can share information. Customers and clients have a voice in ways that they didn't in the past. And that is actually changing the way businesses have to react. So when, you know, financial services firms launch new initiatives, they have to be ready for their customers or clients to respond instantly, whether it's sharing on Twitter or YouTube or whatever it might be. So the way that we have to respond to our constituents is changing as well. And yeah. I think that will inform better business strategy.
And by the way, I'm all for the whole idea of this, because if you think about it, we're doing a podcast right now. It's talking to tens of thousands of people. And the whole idea is for educational purposes. It's also for introductional purposes, sharing of ideas. I mean, I have an audience that shares all sorts of things with me and I share with them. So I get this. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I'm trying to just look for the negatives, no. You know, but there is some, you know, I always want to make sure that I'm, you know, when I look at this, I look at both sides very clearly. Now, you mentioned before we talked earlier on that you have an assessment, or explain this assessment that you were talking about maybe as a giveaway.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a free connectional intelligence quiz that you can take and a manager guide. So if you're interested in learning more about how to use this concept to actually create breakthroughs within your team, within your company, or even with your kids, you can get it for free from me. If you text the number by phone 66866 and type in Erica, E-R-I-C-A, you'll get the details to get the free assessment and manager guide. That's 66866 and text Erica, E-R-I-C-A. And then you can also, you know, check out the book, Get Big Things Done, off of Amazon or Barnes & Noble's, or learn more at ericadewan.com or getbigthingsdone.com.
Well, we'll put all that information on the show notes for this episode. And I really appreciate you coming on. Very educational, informative. And sorry if I was banging you up on a couple of these questions.
Oh, no. Andrew, I love a spirited debate. That's why it was great to speak with you. Thanks so much again.
All right, thanks. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. And as Erica mentioned, you can get her information by that simple texting that you can do, 66866, and type in Erica. You get her assessment. I don't know, if you have any information you want to share with me and you want to mention to me about what we just talked about, I would love to hear it. I also want to mention something to you that's very important. There has been an update, or a, you know, for the new year, of the Aero Strategy summary and review and informational pack that we have. If you haven't gotten it yet, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Look where it says Aero, A-I-R-O, and that's the strategy we use for utilizing our algorithm that we built on the S&P 500. We use the S&P 500 because it's a very liquid, it's a very logical, and it's a very efficient way to find bottoms and tops of markets, very key and very selective, overbought and oversold, not your mama's old overbought and oversold, not your grandma's, not your grandpa's. We're talking about utilizing about 15 different characteristics that go into the overall strategy methodology to find where those very key levels of overbought and oversold levels are. So we're either long buying, short selling, or out neutral. That gives you some great diversification, especially if you utilize this outside of a traditional portfolio where you maybe have asset allocation or equities, it gives you another dimension of diversification that may or may not work directly with your current portfolio. In other words, it may give you a hedge if we're seeing a major top come. Algorithm tells us that, hey, you know what? This is where we're going to start looking at the market moving. We don't necessarily just sell out right there, but we find where the trend changes from that positioning and then try to follow that trend from there. And if, in fact, you have a long-only portfolio outside, well, maybe this would act like a hedge because it will take you out of the market for the Aero strategy, utilizing an ETF that we have for this, or it may even go short, giving you some kind of a significant hedge against market risk. So it gives you a nice diversification. You need to check it out. You'll get the information that shows you historical reference of the algorithm of the S&P 500 and comparison. Very interesting chart to take a look at if you haven't seen it yet. Now, let's get to a listener question here. And then we're going to talk about some of the information about the S&P 500 earnings that I think is pretty interesting. Let's see. All right. So we have a couple of different questions here. This is from Mason, University of Minnesota. He said, I have two quick questions. I'm a young listener, 20 years old, and I hear things thrown out a fair bit about them. Guess I'm just not sure where they come from or how they're determined. The first thing is a target price and how you determine one. My other question is, how do you find discounted stocks and what makes a stock discounted, so to speak? All right. So let's stick with the first one, the whole idea of a target price. Target prices, from what I can see, can be developed a couple different ways. So when you're looking at a stock, and let's just use the number 20 as the stock price at this point. Well, you can either use a valuation based on fundamentals, looking at what the stock valuation is based on, let's say, price earnings and book value, what's the assets versus liabilities, or the what they have on the balance sheet, what the net equity is. What is the comparisons of other stocks in the same exact universe? How are they trading? How are they multiplying? And if you can come up with all of that, you may say that, well, this stock should be worth $25 compared to all the other stocks out there because I'm looking at that current PE multiple of this stock. I'm looking at the growth momentum. I'm looking at all these different characteristics. Now, that's difficult to do because unless you are a seasoned analyst and you understand the math behind all of the different core components that are derived from a balance sheet or an income statement, the problem is that you're really not going to have a great amount of ability to really target a price because what happens is that that's a moving program, a moving target, so to speak. Because each quarter that something else comes out, there's adjustments to other companies with their earnings. And what happens is that you may not be able to actually get a real good significant multiplier available. Now, if you are good with that, and if you can do that kind of work and that kind of study, I think that's a great way to target the valuation. But again, some of that has to do with this kind of plus and minus to all this. Again, that has to do with the overall level of sophistication you have. Now, the other way to do it is a little bit simpler, is to use technical analysis. Now, this has its limitations as well. Lots of times I like to use a balance between the two. But in technical analysis, you're using charts, using pattern recognition, using trends, using indicators. But what you're looking for here is something like a level of support and resistance, and then the next level that you can calculate as being a level of support or resistance from that to find a target price. Now, usually you want to use a longer term. I would use a daily plus a weekly, maybe even monthly, because if you're dealing with target prices on a long-term basis, especially if you're blending in fundamentals, can't use fundamentals for short-term day trading. But if you're using the target price based on fundamentals and you're trying to then confirm it with technicals, you want to use daily and weekly, longer term. Now you find where those levels are, and then you say, that is where I will sell or short or buy or sell my long, whatever you're going to do. That's the target price, and that's an important lesson right there. You want to make sure that you have that embedded, written down, and you stick to it. Now, on a day trading basis, you could do the same thing. You look for prior resistance, prior support. Those are levels that you can target as the when you buy it, you're going to sell it. Next thing, discounts. Now, the same thing we talked about is with target pricing on fundamentals is you can find stocks that have a discount. Now, again, discounted stocks, not going to use technicals with this. You can use fundamental analysis. How do you find stocks that are a discount? Well, the first thing that you could do, very simply, is look at sectors. Let's just look at sectors in total. If we say that the S&P 500 is trading at an 18 times multiple, 18 times 18 PE, and maybe, I'm just picking this out of the blue, the healthcare sector is trading at a discount. And then you look at the individual stocks within there and you find which one is the PE or the PEG price earnings growth rate that has the lowest PEG or a very low PE comparatively. Or you do the same thing in the maybe the financial markets, you do it in industrials, you do it in technology. Again, you find the areas compared to each other that are trading at a discount based on fundamental pricing ratios. Again, you could use that PEG, which I think is important because you're using a price earnings to growth rate. That's a good way to look at things because PE alone doesn't do anything for you. You want to look at price earnings and compare it to the growth in the future. And if you're finding something significantly under a one, you may have something that's trading at a discount to itself. Then compare it to other stocks in the sector and find out how they're doing. There may be a reason, by the way, this is important. There may be a reason why a stock or a sector is trading at a discount. It may not just be like, oh, it's at a discount, so that means it's so cheap, I'm going to buy it. It may be at a discount because that investors are figuring out there's something significantly wrong. And maybe it has to do with economics, pricing. Look at the, for example, the oil and gas sector. Maybe they're saying, you know what, maybe these things aren't so good over here. What you want to do is stay away. They're selling it. Therefore, stocks are trading at a discount, at least right now. And what happens is that you want to make sure to stay away from some of those. So be careful with discounts. But when you look at these, when you look at the discount, or you look at a premium, or you look at targets, all kind of blends together in the same process in terms of looking at the technicals for some of these and more so the fundamentals for others. Okay? So let's see. I had another question here. So here's a question. I thought this is interesting. It says this is from Dave. And, where's Dave from? I'm not sure where Dave's from. He said, I'd like to ask you a question, advice. I'm 29 years old. I just finished my MBA with an emphasis on accounting, and I work as an oil field mechanic. Overall, I've done well for myself through this profession. However, I hear your podcast every Monday, and I would like to break into your profession. I'm interested in starting the process of getting my CFP. I have no school loans. I do have a mortgage. Other than that, I have no debt, and I can afford the school and test. My trouble is, how do I leave a steady job making about $80,000 a year and get an entry job in finance? Where do I start this? I've received little guidance from school so far. This is a big problem. This is not only related to what you're talking about, Dave, here, but the fact of the matter is what happens when anybody wants to change their profession because they don't like what they're in, they don't see a future with what they're in, or they really have a passion for something differently. What I would suggest to you is this, not easy. It's kind of the two-job approach. You need to keep one foot permanently at this point, ground it in what you're doing now and do the best job that you can. But at the same time, start maybe working part-time, start learning, start doing everything you can to gather all the things that you need to work in the next job. Because what happens is that even if you make that transition and you find maybe a major brokerage company, a wirehouse, if you will, that's going to support you, maybe they're going to pay you $40,000 a year, maybe, if you have a potential good book of business that you'll bring in with you. And that will dissipate very quickly. Now, if you're only doing it for the money, it's a very difficult thing. You need to have a good amount of savings. And this is another reason why those rainy day funds are so important to keep going and to keep up. Because you know what? That rainy day may be not a rainy day, but it may be a change of scenario, change of location, change of business. And these all these things will be very helpful if you have some money to back you up. Now, you could take out some loans, of course, and make sure you are very careful with this and live on that for a while, but I don't know if I would really suggest that. What I think you really should do is this. If you want to get your CFP, do it while you're working at this other profession. Make sure that you like what it's all about. And then what you do is start going out there and finding if you could work, I don't want to say part-time, but at least working with someone on a part-time basis, learning from them, and then start making the transition. The problem in this business is, my friend, that you're going to usually have to have some kind of book of business for anybody to take you on, or if you want to be in your own practice, which is something that you may want to do, The problem is, again, that you're going to be pretty much starving for a while. And then what? It's not easy. There's no real answer here. But I think that you could reach out to other friends that are in the business, find out how they did it. And if you're really thinking about breaking away from this other business that you're in right now, your other career, you'll find a way to do it. But I think baby steps is the way to do it. Slowly but surely start transitioning over. All right. I mentioned at the beginning of the show about what's happening with earnings season. And I'll mention that we've gone through earnings season with the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, and we've looked at many of the stocks that have made it through. And I got to tell you something. One of the things that we do with that strategy, if you haven't checked it out, is that we look at about 5,000 stocks or so, and we put it through a very stringent filtering, or we call it quantitative analysis program. And we look for who has the best earnings growth consistently. Who has the best revenue growth, margins that are expanding. We want to make sure the balance sheets are in good quality. And what we look at is how many stocks actually pull through that particular screen. Is there 10, 50, 100? We have found that over time, when we see that the numbers are expanding in the numbers of stocks that make it through that screen, it's a good testament that things are okay when it comes to markets, in terms of the economy. When they start to condense and we see maybe only 30 names, the average is about 60 to 80, give or take. When we see that really start to condense and we only see maybe 20 or 30 names, that's a warning sign. And what happens is we naturally expand and contract the portfolio with the number of stocks that we're seeing that come through that particular screen. Now, let's kind of talk about what's going on right now with the S&P 500 in terms of the results so far. Now, this is according to FactSet, and I got some information off Briefing and a few other places. So through last Friday, about 442 companies, or about almost 90% of the S&P 500 have reported quarterly results. Now, according to the research over at FactSet, about close to 70% have actually beaten earnings, while about 21.5% have missed. The percentage of companies that exceeded earnings estimates is towards the high end of the average, and this usually starts to come down a little bit towards the end of the earnings season. For example, it was about 74.5% about 2 weeks ago. Now, the fourth quarter reported earnings were up about 3.5%. They're now expected to end the fourth quarter up about 4.3% versus about the less than 0.5% estimate that was at the beginning of the earnings season. You know, what happens is that companies tend to offer guidance to set the bar pretty low and very low in the beginning of the period or even the quarters before in order to exceed estimates when it comes to the time to report. Now, if we exclude the energy sector entirely, where earnings are down about 23%, the S&P 500 reported earnings are up about 7.2%. If we exclude Apple, earnings are up 2%. Apple accounts for about half of the S&P. Listen to this. Apple accounts for nearly half of the S&P's reporting earnings growth. I'll say that again. Apple accounts for nearly half of the S&P 500's reported earning growth. That's amazing. Troubling, too. Earnings are up about 24% in the healthcare sector, led by biotech stocks, which are up about 95%. Earnings are up about 9% in the technology and industrial sectors, while earnings are down 2% in the financial and consumer staple sectors. Now, in terms of sales, fourth quarter reported sales are up about 1.7%. Now they're expected to see, by the end when we finish, expect to see about 1.9% up for the quarter. 60% of companies have beat estimates in terms of sales. First quarter earnings are now expected to fall about 5%, with sales down about 4.5%. That's next quarter. Earnings out of the energy sector are expected to fall a whopping 65%. In 2015, earnings are expected to grow about 2.5%, with sales down about 0.8% after growing 5.5% and 3.3% in 2014, respectively, the last couple of years. Earnings are expected to grow 8% with sales up 2% in January. And you can see how that's been dropped dramatically down to about 2.5%. Now, remember something. Companies massage these pretty well. Companies do a great job at managing their estimates so they can beat. Earnings growth was expected to be in the double-digit ranges at this point in 2013 and 14. So when we're looking backwards, and what everybody expected to see was that a major amount of optimism was there, but the reality seems to be much different. There are two notable headwinds in the current market: declines out of the energy sector, expected to fall about 53%, and the strong dollar. Now, in terms of valuation, the S&P 500 now trades at about 17.8% expected 2015 earnings versus the 15-year average of about 16 times. So what we're saying is that we're seeing that earnings potential will be falling dramatically. We're not talking about just a slight amount of guidance differential. Definitely a fall of earnings and sales coming into the next part of 2015 through the end of 2015. And even if we do not see that kind of rapid drop in earnings and sales, the fact remains that about a year and a half ago, we were expecting to see that at this point, we should have seen massive gains, double-digit gains in the S&P 500 earnings as compared to what we're seeing now, which is pretty much just 2% or so. Now, with that in mind, 3% we'll say, with that in mind, does the S&P 500 deserve the multiple of 17.8, and is the earnings going to grow into that multiple? The answer is unequivocally no. So why is it happening? Well, because that's what happens when you have liquidity and probably 9 or so different central banks around the world pushing on the plug of more stimulus, lower rates, liquidity, quantitative easing. Now, when that liquidity dries up, when interest rates start to rise, when there's all of a sudden less stimulus or less stimulative efforts being imposed for whatever reason, we may see the S&P average of about 16 or lower earnings multiple play out. But right now, people don't care. Investors really don't care. They keep on pushing things up regardless of what the actual economic news is and what the actual earnings news is. And don't forget that even so, all this being said, if we keep on seeing that Apple continues to have massive earnings as it's had, I don't know if Apple will be able to continue this kind of expansion of earnings over the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years, unless they have a blockbuster on their hands when it comes to the watch. Because the saturation of iPhone 6s is pretty significant. Now, if they come out with something just revolutionary for the next iPhone somewhere down the road, the iPhone 7, the iPhone 8, I don't know, maybe. But right now, if we look at the totality of all of this and understand that the growth of the S&P 500 earnings is really muted and will be due to the headwinds that we'll see over the next few months and few quarters, and the analyst estimates are coming in pretty dramatically, not just a little bit lower, but dramatically lower, with a 17.8 multiple tacked on to the S&P 500, that's where you need to be careful. I've been saying this for a little while here. We're really nowhere to be seen. I mean, yeah, we hit a record this year on both the Dow Jones and the S&P, and we're about 2% away from a record on the NASDAQ. Small caps are high at their highs as well. But you know what? You have to remember something. That corrections start when you least expect it. So I'm just kind of just throwing that out there just to give you a little bit of a heads up, a little bit of a warning, and something to just chew on right there. We're going to end it right there on that semi-good, semi-bad note. And if you have questions or anything you want to find out more about the Aero strategy, TDI managed growth strategy, or the global allocation strategies, which you should know about, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check it out. Otherwise, thanks for joining me. I'll speak to you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.